Today, we're excited to dive into the intriguing universe of one of the world's most controversial and significant revolutionaries, Bhagat Singh. His impact on India's independence movement is undisputed, and his essay, Why I Am an Atheist, remains an evocative and provocative literary masterpiece till this day. Join us as we uncover the engrossing stories behind Bhagat Singh's transformation into a revolutionary. Together, we'll dive into intriguing topics such as how Bhagat Singh's encounters with colonial rule and his age influence his political perspectives and strategies for resistance, the philosophical underpinnings of his views of religion, its role in society, and how these beliefs fueled his anti-colonial activism. The intended aim of his essay, Why I Am an Atheist, as a counter to critics who charged him with egotism and arrogance, as well as a comparison of his beliefs with those of the Hindustan Socialist Republican Army. Furthermore, we'll explore how Bhagat Singh's atheism coincides with Sikhi and delve into the relationship between skepticism and anti-colonialism in Bhagat Singh's writings. Throughout our conversation, we'll also discuss Bhagat Singh's portrayal in the media, and as we wrap up, we'll ponder the modern relevance of Bhagat Singh's ideologies in today's global political scenario, a world strikingly similar to the one that Bhagat Singh inhabited. So make sure to watch this until the end to uncover the extraordinary life, convictions, and legacy of Bhagat Singh.
So I'm Daniel Elam. I'm an assistant professor of comparative literature at the University of Hong Kong, and I work on anti-colonial thought, mostly from South Asia, but also from North Africa, the first half of the 20th century. That includes, most famously, M.K. Gandhi, but obviously more importantly for today, a figure like Bhagat Singh.
Just out of curiosity, how did you get into this field and how did you end up becoming the professor at the University of Hong Kong? Because it's always interesting how people kind of go from A to Z, so to speak.
I have no idea how I became a professor at University of Hong Kong. So that's a mystery to me still. But the way I kind of found my way to Bhagat Singh was because I was looking for a kind of someone to articulate a sort of radical political philosophy that foregrounded egalitarianism, the foregrounded kind of transnational vision or international vision, and was outside of Europe. I mean, I think I had a training in comparative literature as an undergraduate. I kind of ran a number of different kind of leftist bookshops and in kind of info groups. And what I was finding, even though I was very excited about this kind of leftist thought coming out of North America, coming out of Western Europe, was that something was missing. There was certain, even when it began to speak this kind of cosmopolitan universal language, it still was, as we all know, very limited by its imagination. To put it more bluntly, it assumed that everyone was a white man, a straight white man of a certain class, blah, 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 blah. And it spoke in that universal tone, and it had no consideration for trying to think about any other person in the world through the lens of this kind of now fairly kind of common standard post-colonial critique of Western philosophy. I found that there were certain thinkers in the 1920s and 1930s in Western Europe, and many Jewish thinkers, many Jewish academics working in under or outside of Nazi Germany, thinkers in North Africa, someone like Frantz Fanon, and thinkers like Bhagat Singh in South Asia, who kind of began to critique their political philosophy from the position that acknowledged the multiplicity of people in the world, that tried to articulate a different universal position. And precisely because these are people, figures like Eric Auerbach, Frantz Fanon, Bhagat Singh, who begin their analysis of political philosophy from the position of oppression and then thinking outward from that. So thinking about thinking about justice, thinking about equality, thinking about egalitarianism, even sometimes questions of liberty or freedom, in some iteration, but from the understanding or from the vantage of someone who has been oppressed and thinking that, as opposed to the top-down model of this kind of, the canon of Western political philosophy. I found that first in Lala Hardayal, who was the leader of the Ghadar Party, which was based out of Punjab in California. And I was very excited about Lala Hardayal's vision for, he had many visions throughout his career, but one of them was this kind of anarchistic world state where it was self-care and care for others was, their friendship was the basis of a really radical revolutionary vision. And then I found that in Bhagat Singh, as someone who, a very, very young age, kind of embarrassingly, given how old I am now, was thinking about questions of anarchism, was thinking about questions of taking care of others in the world, was thinking about questions of equality from this position and with a truly kind of radical view of what the world isn't and what it should be, or what it could be, and also what it should be. And I think that that's where Bhagat Singh start becomes really quite exciting. The other thing that I like about Bhagat Singh, the other thing that drew me to Bhagat Singh in particular, is that he is a thinker, not simply because he was 19, 20, 21 when he was writing, but he's a thinker who foregrounded his own learning. So he was not someone who kind of came at political philosophy as though he knew everything, as the expert, the master of having thought through all of the domain of political philosophy, but rather as a student. He really kind of foregrounds his, like, you know, where he's getting his thought from. He changes his mind. She shows us how he changes his mind. And that's really exciting. And that's that kind of what in a different kind of idiom might be called humility. That seems like a really crucial piece of his political philosophy, even if it isn't articulated as such. But the methodology of writing for him seems to me to foreground a sort of humility or egalitarianism through that kind of humility.
No, definitely. One question out of curiosity is how does his Sikh influence or his upbringing influence, and like, how does it influence anything? Like, as in, it must have played some part of creating who he was. And I guess what I'm actually trying to ask is, how did that influence him and kind of mold him? But then equally, how did that develop, I guess, in line with his own philosophy and his own political views of the world?
That's a great question. I think another way of thinking that question, or at least the way that I have been thinking that question, is that Sikhism never disappears. Sikhism is at the foundation of his thought. And so when he talks about atheism, when he talks about anarchy, when he talks about these other kind of, when he talks about even kind of like a kind of Punjabiate identity, Sikhism still grounds him in a number of different ways. I mean, I think the most kind of obvious one is this kind of commitment to a certain type of revolutionary martyrdom in the service of a kind of radical equality. I think these come very, very much from his upbringing as a Sikh and as and within the kind of tradition of Sikhism. I would say that kind of through line, been kind of closely related, obviously, the kind of through line of his identity is also very much Punjabi. Punjab remains a really kind of central place for him to think about. He thinks the world from Punjab. In other words, he uses Punjab as a way to think about worldwide revolution, cosmopolitan brotherhood. And in a lot of his early writings, right, he's thinking about Punjabi script. He's thinking about the kind of very peculiar and certainly to South Asia, the very peculiar, for lack of a better term, multiculturalism of Punjab. And this is right, this is in the 1920s. So of course, right, this is a non-divided Punjab. And so much like the Ghadar Party, which really did a lot of work to think about how to bring Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs together, right? Punjab is the basis for thinking that. And the tragedy of Punjab is that the British took the chance to divide it along those very lines. I think Bhagat Singh, much like Har Dayal, much like the Ghadar Party before him, really thought about what cosmopolitanism, universalism, equality, egalitarianism look like with difference as the very basis for thinking that. He's very, very, very good at citing who he's getting his thoughts from. I mean, one of the main thinkers that he has certainly learned from is Lala Lajpat Rai, who has later been taken up as a certain xenophobic nationalist thinker, but who was actually a very kind of vibrant thinker of Punjab and thinking about difference and justice from within the context of Punjab. I think Bhagat Singh follows very, very much in line with Lala Lajpat Rai's mode of thinking. But what Bhagat Singh does with it is something much, in fact, in some ways, he's thinking about in a way that Lala Lajpat Rai hadn't fully. He's thinking about implementation. So we're going to radicalized implementation of this worldview of egalitarianism and such.
Is that also perhaps his age? Like, he's a bit younger than Lajpat Rai, and there's also this kind of like energy that he has, perhaps, that he's like, well, I know it sounds silly, but when you're younger, you kind of think, well, like, it doesn't matter. Like, as in, I know it sounds stupid, but you're kind of like, it doesn't matter if I die. Like, there's a greater cause, there's something that I'm working for. And I think as you get older, perhaps that maybe changes. Like, I don't know, maybe I'm just kind of generalizing it too much, but it just seems as though his youth, like, he's obviously executed, like, what, 27, 28?
23. He was very, very young.
Oh, sorry, 23. So even younger, which is incredible, right?
Incredible.
So I just, like, as in, you almost can't shy away from the fact that surely his age perhaps has something to do with how much, like, how radical he's willing to go, because there isn't, like, as in, he seems to just keep pushing the envelope.
You're absolutely right. I think so much of the Bhagat Singh that we have, right, because he died at 23, right, is a youthful activist, is a youthful political thinker. And youth is the thing that motivates exactly in the ways that you said, because the willingness to be sort of more radical than one is when one ages, the excitement, the anger. I mean, and these are things that Bhagat Singh has, I don't want to say because he's 19, but certainly being 19 helps in that moment. And there's a couple of people who have thought about this really, really seriously and really, really beautifully. And one is Chris Moffat, who is very, very interested in Bhagat Singh's youth and the question of what it means that Bhagat Singh died so young, what that means for his legacy. I mean, it's very easy to speculate. Other thinkers like Irfan Habib and Chaman Lal and many kind of thinkers about who really focus on Bhagat Singh. You don't ignore this fact. I mean, it's just impossible to ignore the fact that when he wrote 21, when he was writing, there is this desire. I think imagine what Bhagat Singh. I felt this happens to me too. There's this desire to imagine what Bhagat Singh would have become. Had he not been hanged at the age of 23, right? Would he have, so some people think, he would have become a communist. So, he moved from this kind of experimental anarchism, socialism, to a kind of more, formalized vision of communism. Would he have become, so in some ways, disappointing by having gotten old? Happens. and so there's a romanticization of Bhagat Singh, not simply as a martyr, but as someone who could have been something that we wanted him to have been hanged. I think, despite the allure of that way of thinking, I think you're absolutely right to say this is, what grounds Bhagat Singh is, is Sikhism, is Punjabism, but what really kind of invigorates Singh, Bhagat Singh, is youth.
Just then focusing a little bit more on his kind of atheism and those beliefs then, could you kind of just give us a brief overview, so perhaps in just like a few sentences for those listening, as to what are some of the factors of his atheism?
Let's start with atheism. That's the one that we answered. So one of the reasons why Bhagat Singh has a reputation, is known or thought of to be an atheist, is because he writes this kind of pamphlet, Why I'm an Atheist, literally shortly before he dies. I think the thing to be careful about is getting stuck at the title. It's a really exciting title. It's a really provocative title. Obviously, Bhagat Singh loved to write manifestos and polemics. So that title is exciting, obviously. But if we look a little bit more closely at the history of what atheism was in the context of the 1920s, one of the ways that atheism kind of existed in the 1920s was as in the same way that we have it, the kind of knowledge that God doesn't exist, right? That, it's knowledge. It's not unlike agnosticism, for example, where we don't know if God exists, right? Atheism is like a firm belief that God does not exist. That form of atheism does exist in the 1920s. I don't want to kind of discredit or disregard that. But I think that if you read the essay that he writes, the kind of atheism that Bhagat Singh is picking up on and the kind of atheism that he's really kind of excited about looks more like what the word that we would use today would be secularism. So in other words, what he's doing is he's saying, so secularism meaning not in the sense that he's denying or affirming the existence of God, but rather that his investment, his commitment to a world where God, the question of God's existence, is a completely irrelevant issue. This is really exciting for a revolutionary stance, right? Because it tells us a few things. One is it says there's no kind of, he's not acting in a revolutionary manner on behalf of a transcendent belief. He's acting on behalf of fellow humans, right? They are his brothers, his comrades, right? They exist in this world. He can see them. He knows them, or he can imagine their existence, beyond the confines of where he could go. So the other way we can think about atheism, especially in the 1920s, would be what we would call now secularism. So it would be a kind of firm belief in the world without reference to God. So it's not a question of whether God exists or not, but simply a commitment to, and certainly for Bhagat Singh, a commitment to a world where God is irrelevant. He might exist, he might not exist. We might know something about him, we might not. But the world that humans can act in, the world that humans, Bhagat Singh, must act in, is a world composed solely of humans, right? It's a humanly world. So the opposite of secular as I guess we thought out today, is it would be transcendent. So there's no transcendent guidance for revolution, for Augustine. It's the commitment to his brother, to his brothers, to his comrades in this world. And one of the kind of critiques that why I'm an atheist got at the time is that it sounded kind of cocky. It sounded like Augustine was sort of overly confident. But I think, again, another way of thinking about that is actually that Augustine is delimiting the realm of what he can know. We don't know anything about God. We can't. He doesn't, even if he exists, he exists in a way that we can't know him in this world. And so what Augustine is claiming is that every guiding principle of his revolutionary beliefs is based on what he can know, and it's in this world. And that is knowable, right? And so he's not trying to... And so the argument of why I am an atheist is, despite the kind of really flashy title, really about a certain type of commitment to the human world, to the humanly world, to other humans, without the need for a transcendent reference. In that sense, it would not be possible to say that atheism and Sikhism would be opposites, because secularism, the kind of debates around secularism, come out of an Abrahamic tradition, right? I mean, the opposite of secularism is not Christianity. You can be, plenty of Christians are secular in the sense that they behave or should behave in the world in accordance to their fellow humans. One does good in this world as a Christian, as a Muslim, as a Jew, precisely because we have no idea what God wants, but we know what our fellow human want or need, right? So within the Abrahamic tradition, right, atheism would be the opposite of Christianity, Islam, or Judaism. Secularism would coexist with it. It would describe how we act. You are absolutely right. I think a really key tweak to that, right, is the role of, is the Sikhism, which is not an... obviously not an Abrahamic faith. And you were right to, I think it cannot be said enough that it is not even in the model of an Abrahamic faith. One of the kind of key slippery moves that the British make when they arrive in India is to Protestantize all the cultural things that they see to make it in the idiom of Christianity. So when they see something that is Hinduism, then they say Hinduism must be like Christianity. Sikhism must be like Christianity. So it becomes a religion. But as we know in South Asia, right, Hinduism and Sikhism are not religions in the strict sense that they are kind of key texts with very, very specific interpretive tradition, blah, 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 blah. They are kind of all consuming cultural practices and the environment that we breathe, right? They operate entirely outside of the logic of Buddhism, Hinduism, Sikhism, operate entirely outside of the logic of Abrahamic faith. The British were so desperate to make religions out of these not religions that they really closed down a number of key ways we can think about, or we should be thinking about, non-Abrahamic practices and faiths. And so again, this would be another kind of really exciting, I'm really glad that you brought this up. I mean, this is another really exciting way to think about Augustine as an atheist, is that his atheism is not the opposition to Sikhism, precisely because Sikhism doesn't operate as a religion with transcendent categories, but rather Augustine's atheism is fully compatible with, it aligns with and meshes with his commitment to Sikhism. He never isn't Sikh. He never rejects Sikhism. He remains quite true to his Sikh upbringing, to Sikhism, the principles and philosophies of Sikhism. And so atheism in that sense is not, is kind of in keeping, what Augustine is trying to do is make atheism fully in line with the Sikhism that he knows.
Would it be fair then to say that he's actually just saying whether God exists or not doesn't matter? It's not even something we need to deliberate, because actually all we need to focus on is you and I, as in the wider society, and how that should function. And that doesn't need to function in any way, shape, or form in connection to anyone's understanding or ideas or beliefs of the divine, however you wish to describe it.
That's precisely it. That's it. And you said it perfectly well. I think so many revolutionary movements all require a god to be the transcendent guidance or motivation for revolution. Hugot Singh is thinking about a revolution which is motivated by this world, by the necessity of demanding and requiring an egalitarianism and justice in this world in the face of the colonialism, right? And so, right, and I you said it perfectly, right? And it's a certain type of commitment. You know, God is simply, whether God exists or not is irrelevant. We don't have time to debate. I mean, for Bhagat Singh, I think he's someone who's thinking about time running out. And so debates around God's existence are wasting time. We would be bringing about, you know, brotherly revolution right now in this world.
So obviously reading through your paper, you demarcate that kind of Bhagat Singh's essay about why I'm an atheist differs from the Hindustan Socialist Republican Army's response, the philosophy of the bomb. Like, so first of all, I actually never even knew about this other piece of writing, and I never actually understood, I never actually realized that there was almost like a, not necessarily a competition, but there was kind of more branches to the tree, I guess is a better way of saying it. I guess first of all is, who is this other group and how do they work in connection with Bhagat Singh? And then also then, how do these papers contrast or kind of compare to one another?
That's a really good question. Here's a kind of attempt at an answer for that. I mean, so I think, I mean, much like Indian anti-colonialism more broadly, right, there are so many different competing visions for what a post-colonial, independent India-Pakistan should look like, right? So you have anywhere from Gandhi's and Swaraj to Nehru's Congress Party to, you know, Jinnah's creation of Pakistan, you know, as a kind of way of protecting Muslim minorities. They kind of get filtered into, or they kind of get labeled, you know, revolutionary, moderate, Gandhian. And these are helpful categories for kind of clarifying a little bit of things, but then they kind of ignore the fact that within each of these categories, there are competing visions. I mean, so even, you know, Gandhi agrees with Gandhi about as often as Bhagat Singh does, which is to say almost never. But even within the kind of revolutionary party, the Hindustan Socialist Republican Army, that Bhagat Singh is, you know, in some ways one of the founders of, there were constant active debates around what revolution should look like. And so, you know, the most obvious and, you know, the factual inspiration for the HRSA is the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. But Bhagat Singh and Chandrashekhar Azad and his colleagues, right, obviously knew that things that were working are the things that should work in Ireland, or the things that could work, or the things that, you know, the tactics of the IRA couldn't be replicated exactly one for one. They had to be reimagined for a South Asian context. And so although you see a lot of HRSA members really, you know, admiring and taking notes from the IRA and also from the Bolshevik Revolution, you know, what Bhagat Singh is and many, basically the entire crowd of the men who make up the HRSA and also the women are having these constant debates around what revolution looks like. And there aren't any agreements. But I think one thing that the HRSA does really excitingly, unlike the Congress Party perhaps, is that it doesn't attempt to resolve those. I mean, Upanishad Vedic is written about, you know, these kind of long afternoons filled with debates around how many eggs you should eat for, you know, it's for protein, for, you know, is it an appropriate protein for bodybuilding Hindus who also want to be vegetarian? You know, Bhagat Singh cares a little less about that, but is happy to engage. They're watching not simply the IRA and the Bolsheviks, but they're also looking at a lot of protests coming out of North America, or at least the kind of version that gets out of the US. One of Bhagat Singh's favorite films is Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is sort of surprising given that Uncle Tom's Cabin is about white women feeling good about not having slaves. Bhagat Singh is rethinking the text for what it could mean to be revolutionary. So, get back to your question, sorry. If there is a kind of stance that the philosophy of the bomb takes, the HRSA, the kind of primary HRSA manifesto, it's a manifesto. It's a proper manifesto. So it makes demands. It envisions a world. It kind of creates a community of people who are on the side of revolution, on the side of anti-colonial activism, and identifies who the enemy is, and most importantly, identifies the method. Right. This is the text that sets them apart from Gandhi. This is the response to Gandhi. Why an atheist, on the other hand, right, is it appears at first glance to be a manifesto, but it's much more of a kind of meditative essay on how one imagines oneself, how one cultivates oneself as a revolutionary. And so whereas the kind of philosophy of the bomb is sort of making very, very clear statement demands and explaining the kind of, you know, outward-facing vision of the HRSA, why I'm an atheist while still very kind of confident a text, is very much invested with something sort of quieter. It's about, you know, it's about kind of orientation towards the world, orientation towards others, in that sense. I mean, so you can, they're not, and by any means, opposing texts. And in fact, I think the most exciting way to read them is together, as kind of trying to bring about the same vision, but in two very, very different ways.
Just you were discussing the film that Bhagat Singh liked. Now, I actually hadn't written this down, but it's come to me just while we were talking, which is, like, I remember being a child, and when I say a child, a bit younger, and I just remember watching for the first time The Legend of Bhagat Singh, which is kind of like a very, very famous film, and it's actually now on YouTube free to watch completely, which I thought is quite incredible. And I started watching it the other day, and I think actually that's what led me to end up reading the paper, because I was like, why? Because I know there are obviously historical inaccuracies, but I was also just like, I'm going to waste 2 hours watching this. Let me read something instead. So anyway, ended up to your paper, and here we are. My question is, how accurately does the media portray, like, that film can be an example, and I'm sure there are plenty of others, but, like, how accurately does the media portray who Bhagat Singh is? Or as you were saying, like, earlier, because he died so young, there is huge scope to kind of reimagine him almost.
I think maybe you should spend 2 hours watching films on YouTube. Much more rewarding. The film that I absolutely love is Rang de Basanti, which is a bit more recent, but now increasingly not so. And that's a film which takes a lot of creative license with the HRSA story, Bhagat Singh, Chandrasekhar Azad. But I think that film tells us a lot about how it's possible to, like you said, what can be done with Bhagat Singh, because we've seen a lot. I mean, you can see across South Asia a number of different ways of taking him up. So sometimes you find that Bhagat Singh appears in RSS documents in very far right, very horrifyingly xenophobic documents. He's kind of a hero within that tradition. I couldn't tell you how that it's worked out, the mathematics of that. Because he's so young, because he kind of foregrounds his process and his learning, and in that he's still learning, and his ambivalence about all of these kind of various political forms, he's very easy to take up by any number of people. So the far right can take him and make him a hero. The far left can take him and make him a hero. He has something to say, or he has, you know, you can find something somewhere in Bhagat Singh's writing to support that the claim that you want. I think Rang de Basanti gives us a good example of precisely how adaptable his afterlife, his legacy is, because it foregrounds that it's imagined. We romanticize that scene, which sort of didn't exist for Bhagat Singh. It existed for Chandrasekhar Azad, of the shootout with the police, right? We kind of imagine that moment where Bhagat Singh throws the bomb into the assembly and those Inqilab Zindabad, right? I mean, all of these moments are really great for taking a Bhagat Singh that we want and making him into who we want. I think to go back to what you said earlier, it's precisely in some ways that he died so young, that youth was such a motivating factor for him, that it makes him especially adaptable to any sort of reading. I think that's why it's all the more important to go back to do our best to go back to that moment where he's writing, and to remind ourselves that he's 20, to remind ourselves that his citations are in formation, to remind ourselves that we were once 20 and we were not as clear thinkers as Bhagat Singh. I certainly wasn't. But that to foreground that as part of Bhagat Singh's process and legacy seems to be a way of guarding off, you know, that kind of infinitely adaptable afterlife that he seems to be able to take. I mean, I would be curious to hear more, like, I mean, how do kind of Sikh insurgency movements after 1945 pick up this, you know, the martyrdom of Bhagat Singh?
I think what's interesting is because of the fact, and this is partly why I wanted to do this podcast, is because there is not a confusion. I think there's an ambivalence towards Bhagat Singh because of the fact that he declares, I know we've discussed it, but just going back to like the general knowledge, he declares he's an atheist. And I think unless you kind of do dig a little bit deeper and kind of figure out what's really going on, you take it for face value. So I think for some, there's an ambivalence because he's not taking up the fight directly under the banner of Sikhism, if that makes sense. Whereas a lot of the insurgency, especially from the 70s onwards, is directly declaring it under the banner of the Sikh Brotherhood, so to speak. And so it's not to say he's not accepted. Like, he is widely celebrated on his Shahidi Day, as we would call it, on his Martyrdom Day, equally on his birthday. And that's also, I guess, because he's the son of Punjab. Like, he's seen as coming from the soil, just like Udham Singh. And again, what's interesting is they're accepted as martyrs or as shaheeds within the Sikh tradition, although they themselves, for like this is just talking in kind of general, they themselves haven't taken on the whole Sikh garb, if that makes sense. So they're not, like, they cut their hair. Udham Singh is I think when he's hung or whatever, like, he's started to grow his hair back. But Bhagat Singh, like, he's like, his photo, the famous photos of him, is in a mustache with his hat on, right? Like, when you think of a Sikh, you don't think of that per se. So I think that has had an influence on how much he's been accepted. But I think that's also, if, like, being quite frank, I think that's also a disservice, because it's not actually appreciating him in his context. Like, and actually the other thing is even post, even the insurgency post independence, especially during the 70s and 80s, there are loads of people who take up the call to arms, who also are Sikh, but don't necessarily visually keep a turban or grow their beard. So it's just interesting to see how almost allegiance to the philosophical outview almost dictates how much then they're accepted or not. But it's very overlapping, because they're also accepted because they're from Punjab. They're also accepted because they're fighting colonial oppression. They're not necessarily then accepted because, in Bhagat Singh's case, he declares he's an atheist. And so, yeah, hopefully with this podcast, we can kind of make people think a little bit more, and maybe perhaps, like, we'll change something, or somebody somewhere will think twice about this.
You're right. The most famous picture of Bhagat Singh is the mustache and the chulbi. I would say maybe the second most famous picture of Bhagat Singh is when he's in jail and he's wrapping his turban. I mean, he's growing his hair back, and he retains a commitment to Sikhism, and there are ways that could kind of foregrounded in iconography of him after his death. But I mean, you're absolutely right that there's this kind of weird tension between the trilby wearing kind of white earring, Bhagat Singh, and the kind of fairly devout Bhagat Singh in jail, who is practicing. I'm going to blink on the author, but then there's a long tradition within Judaism of, you know, the Jewish thinkers that we kind of go to think Judaism were themselves kind of ambivalent about Judaism. So, I mean, there's a book called The Non-Jewish Jew, which is very much about this kind of, the key figures of iconography of a kind of interpretive tradition within Judaism were a little bit on the fringe, had half a foot out the door, or, you know, were contemplating it. I think maybe, I mean, that you might, I wonder if the same case might be made for Sikhism, that the kind of most vibrant thinkers of Sikhism had a sort of ambivalent, or appear to have a sort of ambivalent relationship to Sikhism. So you don't, which makes them really vibrant thinkers. They can think the contours of what Sikhism can do. They can think about the poorest contours of its practices. And that makes, I mean, that you know, in some ways, so the canon of thinkers isn't at the center, but rather at the periphery.
But I think what's interesting, just as we're talking, is that Bhagat Singh comes across as someone who could be like you or I. Like, he doesn't have to be living in 1919 or like when he's, well, he's executed then, but as he doesn't need to be living at that point in time. And I think what's interesting is we idolize him or appreciate him for what he's done and kind of obviously the steps he's taken, but actually that's just him as a Sikh in a colonial world responding to everything that's going on around him and responding in whichever way he thinks is fit, full stop. Like him, whether, like, as in his. So I think the problem is looking back at history, everyone loves to get their measuring stick out and be like, oh, well, he's this much of a Sikh, or he's this much of a Punjabi, or he's this much of a whatever it is, or their idea of a man, or their idea of whatever it is. But actually, just like we are today responding to just the environment around us, he's doing the same thing. And I think you're right. If we don't go back to that point, we don't actually, like, we can't understand him because we're viewing, like, we're almost trying to view him rather than, like, see in his head. Like, we're almost trying to look at him in the box rather than trying get in the box with him and go, all right, what's going on in here? Like, what are you actually trying to do, right? One question that I also wanted to ask you is, do you think his kind of atheism, or his type of atheism, so to speak, is also a reaction to obviously the British Empire in Punjab at this point? Jallianwala Bagh happens, and he's obviously going to hear of it. But my question is actually, the British Empire is very much God save the king and God save the queen, and it's like Christianity and it's God, and there's everything is under this banner of like they're doing it for the greater cause. Is the atheism in some way a response to that? Or actually, we've seen the destruction that can occur and the impression that can occur under this form of religion, godliness, whatever you want to call it. And actually, he's almost saying, like, he's actually just rejecting the whole thing. He's saying, we can't, like, we're not taking that same stance.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really fantastic way of thinking about it. And especially because, as you said, the kind of one of the organizing principles of the British Empire is to religionify the people it conquers and then to create the division. So that it worked very well in the case of India to create this kind of impossibly unbridgeable gap between Muslims and Hindus, which the British kind of are able to fabricate from very little scraps. Or in Ireland, right, this kind of to say that there's some kind of unbridgeable difference between Catholics and Protestants, which has to be, you know, which the British Empire so graciously intervenes. And in the context of South Asia and the British Raj, Sikhs occupy this kind of very bizarre position where they were the most manly of men. This was not reason then to admire or give equality to Sikhs, but rather to, in that case, quite horrifically, to put a lot of Sikh soldiers on the front lines in front of white men on the battlefields of World War I. And so in addition to this kind of divide and conquer mentality around religion, that the British Empire is able to kind of Christianify everything and then divide it, Sikhism then carries this additional kind of weight of masculinity and violence in some sort of way, manliness that the British really fetishize, but in really kind of, you know, to very cruel and so think Bhagat, and Bhagat Singh is someone who actually is sort of brawny. One of the many things I like about Bhagat Singh is that he is very much 19. He has crushes on Bollywood actresses. He is, and when we see pictures of him in jail, he's kind of lanky. He's not that consciously refuses to be that image the British Empire wants Sikh men to be. And is very, I think precisely in that image of him with the trilby and the mustache, is able to really push back at those really nasty, really nefarious stereotypes the British Empire blindly relied on after they created them themselves. I mean, I think you said a few minutes ago that Bhagat Singh could look like either you or me. One of the ways that Bhagat Singh gets picked up in a kind of in his afterlife, and in a way that we might be a little bit more critical of, is that it's precisely that image of him in the trilby and mustache which makes him actually look more like me. And this was it was precisely that he was able to pass as white in this moment where the police confront him, he's able to pass as white, that then becomes a certain type of celebration of the kind of the wheatish, the light-skinnedness of Punjabis. And I think that really took on a kind of, in the first instance, that was a kind of sort of in opposition to Gandhi, who was, you know, kind of doubled down on a certain type of stereotypical image of a meta, like a slightly emaciated man in a kadiflap, Pagasing is white but not white, and part of his allure. I think if the kind of opposition is Gandhi, and it's Pagasing's Inqilab Zindabad, worldwide revolution, and that's the cosmopolitanism of his photo, versus Gandhi's very provincial Indian looking, stereotype Indian looking performance. That would be one thing. But I think one danger of Bhagat Singh's legacy is that it takes a certain type of colorism and privileges the lightness of his skin, which has, as we know, really, really nasty effects within South Asia. It would be part of the myth of Bhagat Singh is that he can pass as white at this moment of really daring. Bhagat Singh was a great publicist. I mean, he knew how to get himself attention, and that photo was, that was so staged and so brilliantly so, right? So someone like Kama McLean has written about how that photo, along with the, because it circulates next to a photo of Rajguru, that photo is PR, is a PR campaign. And it's one that Bhagat Singh does himself. I think he knows what he's doing. I mean, perhaps with the ego of a 19-year-old, he knows what he's doing. But he's very, very self-conscious about what an image, what a photograph, what a portrait does when it circulates in the world. And yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It does work. And that trilby and that mustache do a certain type of work that something else might not.
One question that I have to ask is what radicalizes Bhagat Singh? Because this is what is interesting to me is obviously he's like 19, 20, whatever, when kind of things get a little bit hotter and he dies extremely young. Most teenagers aren't thinking about fighting like the New World Order, so to speak. They're more concerned with, I don't know, like finding a girlfriend or something. Like what is it that actually radicalizes him to go, hold on, I'm not going to... Like, I'm paying attention to things that are a lot bigger than just me, especially when he cut, like, as in, he's not necessarily coming from the worst of backgrounds either. So, like, is there one event that triggers him to go, like, I've had enough? Like, a lot of people would argue it's Jallianwala Bagh that is the thing. I don't know necessarily whether the timelines match in terms of his kind of political thought and everything, but is it a progress or is there a point where he goes, all right, I now need to focus this way?
That's a good question. So I think he was, if I remember the math correctly, he was about 12 and not an amateur but when he tells a story of his own radicalization, his own revolutionary, Jallianwala Bagh stands at the center. It was so wildly violent and so such an egregious act of massacre and maliciousness on behalf of the British Empire that, of course, right, it changed Punjab forever. And so even if you were 12 and not in Amritsar, you must have been changed by it. To go back to the person who really kind of, his teacher was Lala Lajpat Rai. And I think Lala Lajpat Rai did, and it's precisely because he came from an educated background that had access to, English and French political philosophy, and that he was able to kind of absorb and synthesize and rework. It was the kind of combination. It's his education and then his education under Lala Lajpat Rai in Lahore, which really pushed him, I think, to be a revolutionary. The moment where he becomes a revolutionary, becomes Bhagat Singh, is when Lala Lajpat Rai is beaten to death. And so part of what Bhagat Singh's mission becomes is to avenge Lala Lajpat Rai's death. I think I was at 19, right? I wasn't avenging anyone's death on behalf of an anti-colonial within. And so we should admire someone who had that kind of, who had the kind of clarity of the importance of the task, even if it had some fuzzy, even if all the strings weren't tightly tied. But again, I think what's so exciting about Bhagat Singh is that, although, he becomes a revolutionary in a really clear sense and a really dedicated sense. He becomes a martyr, and he knows that going on very early on. He's still a 19-year-old boy. And so he's like all of us when we were 19, he has crushes. He has teenage boy obsessions. And so, what's exciting about Bhagat Singh is that you can be a revolutionary and still be 19. you can be revolutionary and still have crushes on actresses. That's not, they're not opposed. You can, and so, you know, this kind of mythologization of the revolutionary as someone who is aesthetic, who gives up a kind of worldly life in favor of, you know, pure activism. Bhagat Singh reminds us that that's not the case. You can go to the movies, you can meet your friends about eggs, you can have crushes on Bollywood actresses, and you can still act on behalf of a, you know, really radical anti-colonial. But and that's the kind of ideal revolutionary, you know, is someone who can do all of that at once.
Definitely. And this is what I enjoy about these conversations, is we get to get a better picture of what we're discussing, because obviously we have like a very popular manufactured narrative of who Bhagat Singh is. Just then mapping Bhagat Singh's thought in kind of the wider context, how then does Bhagat Singh's connect in kind of the more global conversations surrounding religion and philosophy and anti-colonialism, especially post-World War One, which obviously has a huge influence on everything?
Another way of reading Bhagat Singh would be is that he is a phenomenally clear synthesizer of the 1920s, of the post-World War One internationalist moment, a phrase that Ali Raza used. And so what you see him doing in the Jiyangal book, and his manifestos and his writings and his sort of articles, is really trying to capture this global conversation around anarchism, socialism, communism, revolution, atheism, secularism. And he's able to sort of synthesize it in a surprisingly clear way in a 3-page essay, you know, for a newspaper. And so what you see in Bhagat Singh's writings, even kind of the really early ones when he began writing, is someone who is very well aware of the wide range of political philosophy after World War One, there seems to be this wild proliferation of, you know, utopian, pessimistic utopian political philosophy. Bhagat Singh is someone who seems to have read all of it and is really kind of thinking of it very seriously. So you see traces of French revolutionary thought, you see traces of Lenin and of Trotsky and the Bolsheviks. You see writings from Thomas Paine on the American Revolution. You see Uncle Tom's Cabin. I mean, all of these things. So this kind of incredibly wide range of views that Bhagat Singh is able to synthesize as revolutionary. In 2023, it's kind of difficult to read Uncle Tom's Cabin or even some Thomas Paine or even Robespierre. These are difficult thinkers to make revolutionary again. But in Bhagat Singh's mind, they were very much able to be revolutionized in the service of an anti-colonial mission. And so in some ways, I guess the parallel would be, you know, if Bhagat Singh is able to take, you know, a sort of someone like Herbert Spencer, Bhagat Singh is able to take Herbert Spencer, who seems to be impossibly British liberal, you know, imperial straight white man. If Bhagat Singh is able to take Herbert Spencer and render him an anti-colonialist in that moment, right, then I mean, he is someone who is aware that afterlives are very much up for grabs. It's not surprising that his own afterlife is very much up for grabs. He's someone who really shows you the kind of, he synthesizes or brings together, or at least kind of takes note of, this wide range of political thought that becomes available around the world after World War One, but especially in India, given a number of different changes in publication houses and circulation of texts, most notably through the Gandhi Party. So a lot of the texts that Bhagat Singh would have access to would have come from California, would have been collected by the Gandhi Party and been brought back by members or brothers of members or someone like that. And so a lot of the kind of really sort of fringe American philosophy around free love and thinkers like Emma Goldman and there's some really weird thought happening in the US that doesn't make much sense, but it's kind of exciting to read. You know, he has access to that because they were published as cheap pamphlets that the Gandhi Party had access to that made it back to Punjab. So the other thing that Bhagat Singh shows us is there's this kind of global circulation of ideas and texts in both the kind of intellectual way, but also in a really physical way. He has access to books and thoughts in a way that previous thinkers hadn't had access to that kind of catalog of political philosophy.
I guess it's like the internet today for then. It's almost like, it's almost like he's being like connected to a mainframe of information that he's able to use. No, definitely. Penultimate question, which is, what is the connection even between doubt and anti-colonialism in Bhagat Singh's writing? And I guess this must come back to his atheism in terms of, like, even that conversation of whether God exists or not involves a reason, like an element of doubt, which actually is just going to, like, you're never going to get out of it because you're just going to continue to, well, you can just keep doubting that, right? So is he almost arguing at this point that there are only some things we can be sure of? Is that kind of where he's going with that?
It may be. I think the way that I read that doubt, or that kind of foregrounding of doubt, is Puckett Singh really trying to position himself as a perpetual novice, as someone who is still in the process of putting together these various thoughts. And so, you know, doubt is another, the assertion of doubt is another way of kind of asserting one's own anti-mastery. And I think, for me, at least in the context of the British Raj, mastery and self-mastery were the idioms that the British would recognize as properly then deserving of independence. For someone like Puckett Singh to say confidently, I don't know, I have these doubts, is to play a really exciting kind of revolutionary game where you kind of rethink mastery as the key piece of anti-colonialism, and you put anti-mastery, you put novice, you put beginner, learner, student, you put these as the categories from which to think a revolutionary world, not the master, because right, one doesn't want to replace the British masters with other masters. One wants to abolish mastery altogether, and so I think doubt becomes a really exciting way to get at that question. And I think that's what's exciting about how Puckett Singh uses doubt in an admittedly very confident way, but how he foregrounds doubt in his own thought.
Incredible. That this is why I love this, because half of the answers I get, I'm like, geez, man, this could be a whole podcast in itself. So no, thank you. Thank you for that. This is a question that I think is really exciting, just simply because of, well, I don't know, it's because I've got older and I'm more aware of what's happening in the world, or it's just because the world's more crazy, I don't know. But what contemporary relevance do you think Puckett Singh's ideas, not just necessarily on atheism and anti-colonialism, but just kind of his whole philosophical outview and everything that he kind of brings? But also I like this kind of element of doubt that he also brings, because he's saying he doesn't know everything. So he's bringing what he has and then also saying, well, hold on, I can learn a whole lot more and there's still a whole lot more to go. But what relevance do you think his philosophy, his worldview, his ethics would have in today's global political climate? Like, I don't know, is there like a news story that you read and you were like, man, Puckett Singh wouldn't have, like, as in, I don't know, like, as in, like, how do you think it would have fit, or what, I guess, could we learn from Puckett Singh in today's kind of landscape?
I don't want to overstate the case, but I don't know if, I would certainly say that we are not yet out of a colonial world. And so the writing, the anti-colonial vision that Puckett Singh lays out in the 1920s is very much against the world that we still inhabit. The British Empire, in its kind of most formal ways, it has kind of dried up, but we live very much in a colonial world, either with new colonial powers or the economic and political aftermaths that still structure a very colonial and hierarchical and oppressive world. And so it's not that reading Puckett Singh is like a glimpse into some kind of past that we don't live in anymore. I think his work is still very much, much like Frantz Fanon, right, who is kind of much more, who's really been taken up around the world in an exciting way, in a way that he deserves to have been all along. Puckett Singh is describing a world we still live in. It might not have the British Raj as its outward-facing features, but the world of oppression, the world of injustice, the world of hierarchy is very, very much alive. And so reading him is not peeking into a time machine. It's giving us another way of reflecting on the world that we inhabit ourselves.
I love that. I just want to check. I've gone through 90% of the questions that I had prepared for today. Obviously, we've been talking for over an hour. I just want to check. Is there anything that you wanted to include, or you think we've missed over, or anything else that you think is just worth mentioning?
I think it's worth pointing out. I think it's a huge part of Puckett Singh's relationship to Sikhism is his commitment to Shahidat and this. The martyrdom remains at the core of his political belief, is very much indebted to Sikhism and has an incredibly vibrant tradition within Sikhism. So in some ways, his commitment to Shahidat is very much a rearticulation of his commitment to Sikhism. The way that he reimagines Shahidat, the way that he reimagines martyrdom in the context of rethinking doubt and rethinking atheism, is that his martyrdom is an end unto itself, right? So Unlike, I mean, you know, perhaps departing from other ways of thinking faith, where one's death matters after it, and you have some sort of transcendent control over the future of yourself, Bhagat Singh is very, very clear that at the moment he dies. And although that moment is a moment for him of martyrdom, it's not one of transcendent martyrdom. It's one of very much of that moment. So I mean, that's a really exciting way that he thinks, or he rethinks, or is trying to rethink this kind of collaboration of, he's trying to think secularism or atheism very, very much in line with a commitment to Sikhism. And I think that Shahidat, I think the martyrdom really stands at the core of that and shows how he's doing that.
It's interesting how he's, I guess, not reimagining it, but trying to think of how it plays a role in what he's doing, because obviously, like, that is the central role to Sikhism. And then so for him, view it as just the, like, that's the end of it. In itself is, I guess, to some degree, and it's that also kind of is a continuation to some of, actually, because the motivating factor for Shahidi per se is just the act. It's not about the reward, if that makes sense. Or there is no reward, like, as in, you're not doing it for X or Y. And so it's just interesting to see how he then applies those concepts in a world that we're still inhabiting, because then that raises very interesting questions about, actually, well, how do you implement that type of philosophy, that type of outlook in today's world? And yeah, I guess we could leave it at that open-ended question.
I think the way that you put it was absolutely right. I mean, I think it's very much a question of, martyrdom is a value in and of itself, not a value accrued after the fact.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it's saying. It's really energizing that tradition.
Because it's not a reward, isn't it? It's not like, oh, I guess in some Judeo-Christian traditions, you have this idea of, like, so if I die, I'm going to heaven, and if I do X, I'm going to get this and whatever and this and that. That doesn't exist in the same way in the East, and it definitely doesn't exist in that concept of Shahidi within Sikhi, because the goal is just the goal. Like, as in, death is death. And I think also the issue there is that the concept of death and the understanding of death in the East, and especially within the Sikh tradition, is radically different to, I may be incorrect here, but radically different to anything that I've seen coming from Judeo-Christian traditions in terms of, like, of just their understanding of it. And it's amazing to then see how Bhagat Singh, at such a young age, is trying to understand how that actually works, because we can theorize it and we can discuss it, but he's actually saying, well, all right, like, what if I actually do it?
He is facing death at that moment, right? So he doesn't have no other choice, right? The kind of closer reference, especially for Shahid, is Islam, right? I mean, and again, this is a, Shahid, martyrdom receives its reward after the, by the life that one will be given after death. That is the logic of Shahid within Islam. That's not the logic of Shahid within Sikhism. And I think that's why Bhagat Singh is bringing this question of atheism to very much in conversation with Sikhism, not as opposites, but actually as the way of thinking what Shahidat, what martyrdom means in and of itself.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because actually Shahidi within an Islamic context is theism, in the sense that there has to be a god for the reward, whereas we're just saying that actually those questions don't even matter. It's actually just about the act, which in of itself is divine. Like, that's it. That is it. Yeah. No, I was going to ask you something else, but then I got interested in that and we went the other way. But no, I can only just say thank you. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
No,
so thank you.
No problem. Much. Thank you. I just think, like, it's great. Like, as once the conversation starts going, you could be here for hours. So yeah, no, thank you so much. Take care.
Jesus.
Take care. And that's a wrap for today's podcast episode, folks. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating it. A massive shout out to our awesome YouTube members, Vishal Kuldar, Sanji and Jagraj, Raj Saran, Kulbir Singh, Ricardo Kular, Wushu Man, Not Devan, Pujangi, Humejit Singh, Amanveer Mandir, Hunter Hid, Radha G. Cole, Gurmeet Dunjal, Gary Parmar, N. Singh, GS and Jazz Dylan. Let's not forget also our amazing Patreon members, including Neil B, Hernan Pazano, Jazz Dylan, Gurpreet Singh, Gurdeep Bhatt, Himmat Singh Khalsa, Anish Man, Ramneet Kaur, Mani Singh, Rav Singh, Yasmin Jaswal, Ramnik Gaur, Gagan Singh, and Gurpreet Dunjal. If you're passionate about the work I'm doing and want to support it, consider becoming a paid YouTube member to unlock some cool features or join our Patreon community. You can find the links in the description below. Thanks again for tuning in, and I can't wait to bring you more exciting content. See you in the next one.